Welcome to the Goddess Divine podcast. Join me as I unveil the stories of goddesses from across time and cultures. We will dive deep into the archetypes and energies that these goddesses embody, and we'll explore the practical applications of goddess wisdom in our daily lives. We'll discuss how to connect with the divine feminine through rituals, meditation, creative expression, and acts of conscious living. Whether you're a seasoned practitioner of goddess spirituality or just beginning your journey, this podcast is for you. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Goddess Divine podcast. My name is Dina. Thank you for joining me for this week's episode. I'm so excited to bring this episode to you. It is, well, it's a little lengthy, so I am breaking it up into two parts, and I'm trying to minimize it and squeeze as much information into each episode. This is a long time coming. I really wanted to complete this episode for you and be as thorough as possible because I think it is incredibly important to remain true to historical accuracy. And also, what I've noticed out there is, you know, people saying, oh, you know, down with the patriarchy, and that's why, you know, females are no longer worshipped in the past. But what I wanted to bring to you, yes, that's true, but what I wanted to bring to you were the details. I wanted to actually show you how the divine feminine was destroyed, dissembled, dismantled, how it was reconfigured for the modern world, essentially, but with historical fact. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. This is granular, can get tedious, monotonous, and a little boring, but if you stick with me through both parts, then you'll have a pretty comprehensive understanding of how this occurred, because haven't you always wondered, well, what happened? How did we just get a male ruler over all of us? I mean, this is a global phenomena, right? This isn't just targeted to specific points of the world. Christianity, which is what we're going to be talking a lot about, because it really is the implementation of Christianity across the globe that is responsible, that is not single-handedly, but almost single-handedly, you know, responsible for the decimation of goddess spirituality, goddess worship, goddesses, period, in ancient society, and the destruction of old world divine feminine, and the reconfiguration of a new divine feminine to suit a specific political and social agenda. So I've always wondered, well, how the hell did this happen? You know, especially as an archaeologist, finding all the figurines of goddesses that were worshipped in the ancient past, I'm like, huh, I'm missing something here. So I did a massive deep dive, and, you know, I wrote a book on Divine Feminine's Guide to Seership, and I ended up spending a long period of time writing a chapter on this topic because I wanted to know, and I thought it would be super irresponsible for me not to understand the past, to not understand how we got to where we are, and to not share this information that I was learning. So what I'm giving you is a little simplified, a little detailed, but simplified version of this narrative. Okay, let's just go ahead and let me get started here. So today's episode is the destruction of the divine feminine. Now, when I say this, I am speaking about the ancient classical world. Let me specify, I picked a region. I cannot tackle the entire world. That is just overwhelming, and there's no way in hell I'm doing that. So I picked a specific area that I knew had a heavy hand, and that was an authority figure on this topic. So before we talk about the actual destruction, which is in part two's episode, it's important for us to understand what the world looked like pre-Christian. Before we had monotheism, what was going on? What positions of power did women hold? What belief systems were in place? And of course, you're probably already thinking, oh, they're all pagans. Well, that wasn't even a term, right? People had their own belief systems, their own practices. pagan didn't become a term for a while, right? And for it to become a derogatory term, that came a little later. So let's talk about the ancient world. What we know through historical facts and through the archaeological record is the divine feminine within a female embodiment was alive and well. You saw this in temples all over the world, right? Across cities. You saw this in public spaces, but you also saw this in private spaces. Women worshipped their goddesses within their own household spaces. They had their own daily rituals that they performed with the goddesses. And men did too, right? But let me tell you something that I think is very important. While women held positions of power and leadership in the past, which we're going to get to in the form of divinity, let's not get it twisted. They were second class, third class citizens. They were slaves. They were the properties of their husbands, of the state. They were disempowered. So I don't want to paint a fluffy picture for women in the ancient past. No, it was rough times. They really didn't have any power, and they weren't authority figures unless they were high priestesses, unless they worked in the temples. Then they got special benefits, and they were recognized as something other than just a normal quote-unquote wife or woman in society. So I think that's really important to mention that women had power in the realm of the divine. So again, what did the pre-Christian world look like? Well, you had all of these temples that were dedicated to male gods, to female gods. You had a lot of festivals all throughout the year, like the Eleusinian Mysteries that were dedicated to goddesses, such as you had Demeter and Persephone. You also had high priestesses who oversaw many festivals, like the high priestess of Athena, as an example, the high priestess of Aphrodite. You had priestesses of Juno, who's Hera in the Greek pantheon. So there were quite a few, right? They made sacrifices. They oversaw the procession during the festivals as well. They also oversaw many rituals. They were the ones who sung the hymns. They were fierce leaders in their own right. You also have to remember that women were the sibyls. They were the oracles. They were the seers. You have to, if you know your history, you know how powerful the oracles were back in the day, and I mean way back in the day. Kings would send their dignitaries. People from all over the world would come to the Oracle of Delphi to get her prophecies. And she determined who would live or die, who went to war, who kept peace, who would get married, etc. So they were very prominent figures. And what's interesting, and I'm just going to throw this little tidbit in there, most of us know that the Oracle of Delphi was a channel for the god Apollo. But little do people know that Apollo came second. She was the channel for Gaia for a long time before it somehow changed to Apollo. And I can't remember that story, but I know that's what happened. Okay. Anyway, you had many goddess cults in the past. You had the cult of Athena, you had the cult of Aphrodite, the cult of Artemis, the cult of Hera and Demeter, and so many more that weren't mentioning, but I'm keeping this short today. The duties and the daily lives of a lot of these priestesses, it really varied depending on their role and the deity that they served and the location that they worked in. But again, just to play this back for you, they performed rituals and ceremonies. They maintained the sanctuaries and the temples. They were responsible for divination and being the oracles. They also shared religious knowledge with the community, and they offered guidance. And again, they were representative of the gods for the people, right? So the priestesses were also segmented into lower priestesses, sub-priestesses. You had priestesses who, you know, could only be priestesses if they were married or if they were unmarried, if they were virgins or if they were old age. There were so many different types. They were active in maintaining the temples and active in weaving the garments for the goddess Athena or Artemis. It was incredible. When I started to do my research, I did not realize the depth of this. But this was a huge part of daily life. It was so normalized and internalized. I can't even imagine how disruptive it would be for somebody to come in and say, no, all these gods and goddesses are fake, and you only have Yahweh. The end. Worship him or else die. We'll get to that. All right. So this is happening also in Rome. As we're full aware of, they pretty much copied the Greek gods, renamed them, but had similar mysteries, like the Eleusinian mysteries. They had similar festivals, I mean, but also high priestesses, and they had the Vestal Virgins as well. Egypt. Let's go there briefly. Women were priestesses of certain goddesses, such as the goddess of Neith, who was very prominent in the old kingdom. Goddesses or priestesses of the goddess Isis. That was extremely huge, we remember. And then the priestess of Amun, who carried a prominent position in ancient Egyptian society. In ancient Mesopotamia, there were numerous priestesses. You had Sumerian priestesses, such as the Entu, the Naritu, Kadishtu. Some of these priestesses served the way that they would serve. They were similar to the way that the priestesses of Aphrodite served in terms of sexual rites, sexual customs, etc. I am giving you such a small glimpse of what the ancient world looks like. Like I said, I wrote a chapter on it where I get into very specific details because I learned so much, especially about like the sexual rites of some of these cults, which was so interesting. I really recommend learning this stuff. I was like, wow, how freeing to be able to do that. Anyway, you had numerous goddess temples and statues that dotted the entire landscape, right? And goddess shrines occupied the small spaces in the home. You had priestesses that were young, old, married, and unmarried, who served the temples, made dedications, created and cleaned the garments of the goddesses, right? All of that. It was everywhere. So how did all of this get erased? This is the question, right? So remember, these priestesses, the oracles, the sibyls, deity worship, the goddesses were vital to the social and political order of the state. So for this to change, this is a massive disruption. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. This episode, minimizing this was a huge undertaking. I was like, let me just read the whole chapter. And you guys are going to fall asleep in like 5 minutes. But I try to find a way to simplify, and I'm doing my best with this episode. But I also tried to figure out, where do I start? Where's the starting place for this? I wasn't sure. And, you know, after doing a lot of reading, I decided, well, given that we all just worship, no, well, actually, I'm really generalizing. I actually shouldn't have said that. Given that a majority of the world worships a male figurehead, a male god only, there's no mention of woman, you know, there's no mother god, there's no mother goddess of the world, like, you know, Gaia, all that's been erased. Maybe I should go back to, well, what happened to the mother god? Because there was a mother god, right? You see this in various cults across the entire world. But given that Christianity is the Abrahamic religion, I thought it would be cool to do some research and figure out, well, where did the mother god disappear, you know, with the Israelites and the Canaanites, since that's where time began, supposedly. So that's kind of where I started. I wanted to understand how a male god came into control. And what happened to his wife? Because lo and behold, God had a wife way back when. And that's my starting point for my research and this episode. So who was God's wife? Her name was Asherah. And Asherah was a big deal back then. She was worshipped in the Canaanite Bronze Age all the way through the Canaanite Iron Age. So it was a long period of time. So let's kind of break down her estimated timeline for a second here. So again, 3000, from 3000 BC to 1200 BC. So a long period of time she was worshipped, and she was a central figure in the Canaanite pantheon alongside the god El. El becomes Yahweh, okay? So they were worshipped together as one. She was associated with fertility, motherhood, and the sea. How do we even know about Asherah? Good question. Well, we know of her at least two different ways. Number one, from the Old Testament, they did not like Asherah, the Israelites. They hated her and they did whatever they could to purge her off the face of this earth. That's in there. So if you want to know, then take a look up Asherah's name and you'll find her mentioned in the Bible. There are many instances where the Israelites are like, yeah, no idols of Asherah anywhere ever, or else you're in trouble. So get rid of her. But when you look at the archaeological record, there are a ton of statues, amulets, and inscriptions to the goddess Asherah. So we know she was super important. So what's interesting is that, you know, the Israelites too were polytheists before they became monotheists. They were influenced by a lot of the different cultures around them. So they worshiped other gods, including El, who becomes Yahweh. But Yahweh and Asherah were worshiped together. And in the Bible, Asherah is depicted in a very negative light, but the archaeological record shows something very different. So that's kind of interesting, right? Anyway, there was a whole abolition of Asherah worship. And I wish I could say I know exactly, I can pinpoint exactly how this happened. But what we do know is that we have Yahweh, who is a jealous God, who is a vengeful God. Do not worship any other gods but me. So what do the Israelites do? They only worship Yahweh, right? They follow that path. And they get rid of all the other gods. There should be no idol worship, remember? That's also part of Yahweh's laws. So Yahweh has this full set of commandments, full set of laws, and that's what they're adhering to. Therefore, they have to purge everybody according to these laws. So they get rid of all the other gods and goddesses, especially Asherah. There's a lot of emphasis on her. And then you have the rise of Yahwehism. So you have this increasing prominence of Yahweh, the Israelite God, and a gradual shift towards monotheism plays out. So don't forget, again, just to mention that Yahweh was often seen as a jealous and demanding God, but he demanded exclusive worship. This meant that all the other deities, including Asherah, were suppressed. Other goddesses who were prominent during this time was Anat. She was a fierce warrior goddess associated with hunting, violence, and justice. And then you also had Astarte, love, fertility, and warfare. And she was worshipped all throughout the Near East. And sometimes she is identified as Isis. That's an interesting story. You had Kudushu. And then you had Ishtar. So you had all these other goddesses who were prominent, who had a prominent role in Canaanite mythology. But yeah, as the kingdoms of Judah and Israel consolidated to power, their rulers probably saw promoting Yahweh as a unifying force, would work, and that would further marginalize alternative religions or other goddesses like Asherah. And again, Asherah had a massive following. I feel like I need to really, I'm understating it here. She was a big deal. So to get rid of her, it was very difficult for the people, and that's why they had to keep punishing the people and going after the people for idol worship, since there were idols of her everywhere. Okay, so the other thing that I wanted to say is a long time passes. So we have, we have this one belief in one God for the Israelites. Right? So how does this impact us getting rid of the divine feminine? Well, looks like it's kind of starting there a little bit in the Near East, where none of the other gods or goddesses are allowed to be worshipped. And they do what they can, all of the kings do what they can to get rid of all the other gods and goddesses and suppress all of that. They certainly tried and they won for some times, and I'm using the word won loosely. I mean, it's very difficult to force people into a new religious belief system. Most people, there are little acts of resistance where you'll find either inscriptions to a goddess, or you'll find statues to a goddess still, or some sort of veneration to a goddess, or even a god by chance. So anyway, this happens for a long period of time. There's efforts to suppress, and I'm putting quotes around paganism because that was not a term utilized then, but to suppress idol worship, I think that's probably the best way I can put it, and to suppress worshiping any other gods or goddesses. Now, I'm going to make a statement here, and I hope I'm right from memory, but one thing I remembered about Asherah, and I feel like the goddesses are helping me with this, was that her following was so huge that Jezebel was a priestess of Asherah, and they hated that. And Asherah had thousands of priests and priestesses and just such a massive following. And one reason they hated Jezebel is because she was an authority figure for Asherah. So that's an interesting little tidbit I wanted to throw in there. Okay, let me go back to my pages of notes that I have here. So let's kind of move closer to the Roman Empire. And between about 4 BCE and 30 CE, or the Common Era, we have kind of a divergence in Jewish beliefs and the interpretations of the scriptures, right? And one of these major divergences is what? Christianity and the Christian view of the law, different interpretation of the scriptures. So this was a gradual process. The split between Judaism and Christianity, it was a gradual process that took place over several centuries, so it wasn't overnight. But you have to remember that early on, Christianity, the early groups of Christians, let me put it like that, the early groups of Christian believers, they were considered a wild fringe group. And they were persecuted hardcore in the Roman Empire. I know it seems like I'm making a jump here, but this jump kind of needs to be made because we're talking about hundreds of years. So just a little bit about the Christians early on, just so we have some understanding. Like, they were considered ridiculous. They were persecuted for a long period of time when they were trying to spread what was considered fringe beliefs, right? They were going against, like, they had a very different interpretation of the scriptures that warrants mentioning. So that's also why they're classified as some sort of wild fringe group. They were persecuted from the first to the third centuries. It was a long period of time. You had the Emperor Nero, who blamed them for the Great Fire of Rome, right? So he initiated the first documented persecution and public humiliations. And then you had Marcus Aurelius, who persecuted them across provinces, right? Then you had Valerian, who ordered the execution of clergy and persecution of other Christians. But then you had some really horrible, severe persecutions that was instigated by the Emperor Diocletian. So this involved the burning of scriptures, imprisonment, torture. It was really, really bad. And then you had people who were martyrs, like during this time, dying for Christianity, you know, because they're being persecuted. Well, this goes on for quite a period of time. And the reason this is going on is because they were considered as threats to the state. Early Christians refused to worship the Roman gods. And so this was seen as a challenge to religious authority. There are so many persecutions, but the one thing I want to add here is that this starts to come to a halt when we hit up Constantine the Great. So let's talk a little bit behind this. So we have Constantine come in, and then he decides to convert to Christianity. So again, a long period of time of persecutions. People really couldn't stand the Christians, especially Roman authority figures and their beliefs. They're pretty aggressive too. But here comes Constantine. He decides to convert to Christianity. Now, why does he do this? This is such a big question, and historians can't really agree, but, you know, it's still debated by them. They think it was to unify the empire. You know, Christianity was starting to gain some popularity in the empire, and maybe he thought that it would unify a diverse population under a single faith. Perhaps he was seeking divine favor. And yes, Christianity was expanding rapidly in the 4th century. And so if he aligned himself with this movement, maybe it would have garnered him more favor from some of these fringe groups. We don't know all of his political motivations. These are just to be taken into consideration, but we know what happened. We know that he did this. So let's talk about the Edict of Milan, because this is during his reign. This is really important. So during his reign, he decides to legalize Christianity within his territory. So this ends the persecution of the Christians throughout the empire. So this is kind of a huge, huge deal. He converts and he's like, oh, Christianity is legal. And we're not going to persecute them like we were before. So this allowed Christians the freedom of worship. And they were allowed to rebuild any place that was destroyed when they were being persecuted. And any property that was confiscated was returned back to them. So now we have, yes, legalized Christianity. And Constantine's all a part of this. During this time, we also have the Council of Nicaea after Christianity has been legalized. And this is really important. And it was a pivotal event in Christian history. So it was convened in the city of Nicaea, present day in Iznik, Turkey. And it was convened by the Emperor Constantine the Great. So the goal of the council was to address a major controversy within Christianity at this time, known as the Arian controversy. One thing I forgot to mention here is that there were various views of Christianity during this time. Okay. So what they wanted to do was consolidate a view, a law. And because there were disputes about, you know, Jesus Christ and different beliefs about him, but they wanted to settle any disputes and decide whether or not, this is just a side note, Jesus Christ was of the same substance as God or was created by God and was subordinate to God. So they had some decisions to make here, but it was kind of important because the council formulated the Nicene Creed, and this is a statement of faith defining Jesus as of one substance with the Father. So it's the cornerstone of Christian orthodoxy. And it continues to be recited in many Christian denominations today, right? But they also meant to condemn any other form of Christianity, because what they just said, the Nicene Creed, is the way. This is the way it is. We determined it, and this is the way for everybody moving forward. All of these other fringe Christian belief, you know, fringe Christian groups, no, you got it wrong, and you either believe us or you're a heretic. So they wanted to standardize the beliefs across the board. And that's what they did by establishing the Nicene Creed. Okay. Later on, after Constantine, we have Emperor Theodosius I. Now, these people are really important. And he issues the Edict of Thessalonica, or Thessalonica, but I'm going to say Thessalonica for our purposes. This was huge. It marked a significant turning point in the relationship between Christianity and the Roman Empire, and it declared Nicene Christianity as the official religion of the empire. And then it condemned all other Christian creeds. This edict also imposed penalties on any of the other creeds and on any other creeds that were of non-Nicene nature. So these two, the Edict of Milan and the Edict of Thessalonica or Thessalonica, were extremely important, and they had massive consequences for the Roman Empire and for Christianity. So again, we have the declaration of Nicene Christianity as the official religion of the empire. So with it being the official state religion, it was granted legal and political advantages over all the other religions. And I'm using the other religion loosely because paganism was not a religion, right? But it had advantages over Arianism, which was another belief system, and paganism. And it condemned all other Christian creeds as heresies. All right. I think that was kind of important to mention because, so again, the Edict of Thessalonica or Thessalonica, I'm probably getting it all wrong, but the Edict of Milan, these two are really crucial in legalizing Christianity, establishing it as a state religion, and then deciding that Nicene Christianity is the true Christianity. So it's kind of crazy how that just happens. So what happens to all the people who are like, what are you talking about? I have my own belief systems. These are the goddesses or gods I worship. All of a sudden now there's one God. So essentially these two edicts, they solidify Christianity's dominance within the empire. And then it essentially paves the way for its further institutionalization. The endorsement of Nicene Christianity really contributes to its widespread acceptance as the Orthodox Christian belief, and it influences theological, it influences a lot of the state structures and theological belief systems. So we have to remember that, you know, these are landmark events in the history of Christianity, and they really do mark a crucial step in its rise to become the dominant religion of the Roman world. So all of this to say, thank you for sticking with all the details. I appreciate it. The beliefs and the practices of this new Christian religion, it just drastically changed the Roman Empire and the classical religious landscape. Because remember what I told you, what it looked like. And I just gave you a little preview. This new religion challenged many of the traditional beliefs and values of the people, the values. And it introduced a new concept of a singular male God. And this had a very profound impact on the way people thought about the divine and even their relationship with the divine realm. I can't even imagine like how it must have been during that time to undergo something like that and then being forced to convert. So as a monotheistic religion, Christianity was just such a radical departure from the polytheistic religions, right, in the old world. You had the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the Celts. They believed in a pantheon of gods and goddesses, and they performed sacrifices, ceremonies, rituals, both public and in private in honor of their god or their goddess. And they celebrated numerous festivals dedicated to them throughout the year. So this is such a grandiose change. Christianity did a few things. It introduced new concepts of salvation to the classical world. And they're saying salvation only through Jesus Christ. But this is in contrast to the polytheistic religions at the time, which often taught that salvation was achieved through rituals and or sacrifice. Christianity also introduced the concept of an afterlife where people would be rewarded or punishment based on their, you know, their actions in this life. Polytheistic religions taught that the afterlife was a place of rest or a place of reincarnation or whatever their belief was. There were sacrifices in early Christianity, but they weren't animal sacrifices, as was the tradition in the Roman Empire. Instead, they were sacrifices of bread and wine, which were seen as symbols of Jesus' body and blood, etc. The other thing I wanted to add here was that Christianity did not have idols, right? Huge thing. Christianity didn't have idols, which are the images of gods and goddesses that were worshipped. Christianity taught that there's only one God and that God should not be represented by images. So as Christianity became more dominant, it began to suppress goddess worship and other forms of polytheism, including animal sacrifice, pagan rituals, and idolatry. Now, in part two, I'm going to discuss how the so-called triumph of Christianity destroyed all of the old notions of the divine feminine, you know, through the theory of original sin. Also, I'm going to discuss how they redefined the divine feminine through an acceptable Christian lens. And they did this, you know, through numerous ways. Number one, through destroying all the pagan temples, all the goddess idols, all the goddess art, and then replacing all of that with Christian images or syncretizing them with existing religious and pagan figures. It's a whole other topic I'll get into later. But this really was just to kind of set you guys up and explain what happened? How did Christianity become the official religion of the empire? What did the world look like before that? How did this change happen? And why did this happen? That's such a big question that many people have. Well, why did this happen? Why did this need to occur? Again, there were many political motivations behind Constantine's decision, likely political motivations for him to all of a sudden convert to Christianity. There are some other theories about this, but what we do know is that the effects of this and making it the official religion of the Roman Empire had detrimental effects. Detrimental to the point that it destroys all of the old ways, or attempts to destroy, I should say that, and suppress. So next week, I'm going to be talking to you guys just about what happens after this. How does Christianity gain a stronghold? And what happens to goddess worship? You know, what strategy did they utilize to get the people to convert? They used several, and that's what I'm going to walk you through, the consequences of all of these strategies, the war on the pagan practices, pagan temples, war on the pagan idols, and on the pagan art. I'm really trying to not make it as granular, but it was a systematic effort by really the Roman Catholic Church to completely dismantle old ways of believing, old ways of receiving, old ways of connecting, and then establish themselves as authority figures on the divine. Thank you so much for listening, you guys, to this episode. It was a lot of work for me to try to simplify this, but also to try to make it not monotonous and not tedious. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that I personally can't even imagine what it was like to have been a high priestess during that time, being responsible for overseeing, you know, these incredible festivals and ceremonies, being an authority figure on the divine, or being a mouthpiece for the divine, and then being told, oh, you're not allowed to be, you're a woman. I can't even imagine that shift in thinking during that time. Anyway, I digress. I'm going on and on. Part two will be next time, and we will talk about the aftermath of, you know, legalizing Christianity and making it the official religion of the empire and shifting to monotheism. Everyone, have a great day ahead, and looking forward to giving you another episode soon. Take care.